Holding Court with Mike Trevelyan and Dean Sheridan. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to this week's episode of Holding Court with myself, Dean Sheridan, and my barrister friend, Michael Trevelyan. This is the podcast where we talk over crimes, legal cases, court cases, and we have a little bit of fun along the way, and Mike teaches us a thing or two. Think of it like the GCSE bite size of law, but with probably things of no use to you. How are you, Mike?
I'm well. I'm delighted to have the entirety of my legal knowledge described as something of no use to the general.
Well, what I meant is, like, some of the stories, I mean, you could pick it up, but you'd probably have to go through, like, the hundreds of hours or whatever. Well, not hundreds, what are we on now? 24? So we've probably got about 25 hours worth of stuff. But yeah, there's plenty to learn from Mike. You just get the tidbits from all of the faffing in between.
But yeah, I'm well. I'm going to have a nice sort of quiet, fun weekend. Looking forward to the bits and bobs I've got coming up. And yeah, it's good. I can't remember if I've said before, but I've had the office in which I record redecorated, and it's just a much more sort of relaxing space than it was. So it's a joy to be in here. I'm very good. I'm very good. How are things with you?
Very, very good. I can see that you've got the pattern on the back is now of leaves going up instead of butterflies.
Yes. So I've gone with the slightly more mature sort of silver embossed leaf motif rather than the pink sparkly butterflies, as you say, that were here before. And overall, it's just a nicer place. And also, I've changed the walls. So instead of being a sort of light purple, it's now like an olive green. With the leaf wallpaper behind being a bit of a feature wall, so it's a nice relaxed spot.
Is this the same room where you play video games as well?
It is, actually, yeah. Unless I'm downstairs in the man cave, but if I'm playing on the PC, then yeah, this is where I do it. It's where the magic happens, Dean.
So now it's become an even more important room.
Exactly, it's become a vital part of my daily routine. Absolutely right.
Okay, so today I'll jump straight in with our first case. And this is actually quite an up-to-date one. It sort of fell into our laps. I would say our laps because I'm sure you've heard of it. You might have heard of Scarlett Johansson, or Johansson, as some people say.
I have heard of her.
And you may have heard of the film Black Widow, which was released recently in the Marvel Cinematic Extended Universe. Is it MCU? No, it's just MCU. I'm thinking of DCEU, which is the DC Extended Universe. No, the Marvel Cinematic Universe in the MCU. And it turns out that due to COVID and such things as movies, which I quite like the idea that movies come straight to streaming, that you can pay a certain set price, so I think it's like £20, and then you get that movie instead of having to go to the cinema on streaming sites. Mainly I've seen Disney do it, and I've seen a few come to Amazon Prime. I rented Mortal Kombat when that came out, the new Mortal Kombat movie, which was all kinds of okay. And
I did a similar thing, actually. I watched is it Gerard Butler? And it was like a sort of apocalypse film. I watched that a couple of months ago, and that had come, I think, straight to Amazon Prime. I can't remember what it's called now, but
I've seen the trailer that's appeared before, like when you watch a program on Amazon, and then they have like a trailer for other things that are on Amazon.
Yes. But if you get the chance to watch it, I'd recommend it. It's pretty, pretty good. A bit easy watching.
I'll give it a watch. You can't beat a bit of Gerard Butler. I used to love Gerard Butler to bits when I realized he played the Phantom, and I used to watch that all the time.
Oh, well, there we go. Why not have a little cinematic reunion with old Gerard and watch him in this latest venture?
An evening of Butler. Well, so yes, in this case, it seems that Scarlett Johansson in her contract had that she would make a percentage of a theatre release run, is how I've read into it. So, and promised that it would hit the theatres, which it also makes sense in a way, because this movie, the Black Widow movie, was meant to have come out last year, I think last summer, I believe it was. And they pushed it back so that it could come out and have a cinema release. And it has had a cinema release. You can go watch it, but also it was released at the same time on streaming platforms. So it seems that the argument is that she is missing out on a level of profit that she would have made from the usual sort of 3 month cinema release, or what is it, month and a half, and then you wait a month and a half for the DVD or Blu-ray version to be released and the digital version. And it seems that she wants that money because she was lied to, and so her agency seems to be going after it. And I believe, but I haven't looked into it fully, that Emma Stone is also jumping on this bandwagon with the Cruella release, because the Cruella film, also a Disney film based on the lovely lady that guts Dalmatians, had a similar style of release, and I'm guessing a similar contract. Now, I know some places, such as Warner Brothers, they renegotiated a lot of their contracts with users when they came up with the plan of releasing all the movies on the HBO Max streaming site. So a lot of movies came out, such as like Godzilla versus Kong, the Mortal Kombat film that I was talking about, all came out straight to HBO Max. And I think the Suicide Squad is also coming out to HBO Max, but we can't get that in the UK because I think Sky has a deal with HBO, which is why all the Sky programs, you have things like Game of Thrones and all that come straight to Sky and those programs on there. So they must have a deal. So I don't know if the idea is wait for that contract to run out. We might get HBO Max. Here's me crossing my fingers because I really want it. instead of paying £20 just to watch Mortal Kombat, which was all kinds of okay. All right. So I believe that Warner Brothers renegotiated a lot of their contracts with some of the people that were starring in these movies that were going, so that they made some money from that also. It does appear that Scarlett Johansson's... I'm going to keep saying Johansson. What do you think? Johansson? Johansson.
I always say Johansson in the same way as I don't say Ulrika Johnson.
Ulrika Johnson.
Ulrika Johnson. You know, like Mark Ronson. All of these names are interconnected.
Well, there we go. Well, what we'll do is we can have one. I'll say Johansson, and then when you respond, you say Johansson. So therefore, yes, we're going to be correct regardless of how we pronounce it.
Well, what we could do is we could record ourselves just saying the surname, and then we could just edit it in once we've worked out.
Just like really terribly out of time. Like, oh, yeah, Scarlett Johansson.
Scarlett Johansson.
Every time.
So, yeah, that's what we're going to do, and it's going to be flawless.
And or we'll just get one of us to say it, so every time it comes up, like, it's your voice, like Scarlett, and then mine, Johansson.
Johansson. Brilliant, good.
But yeah, it appears that her agency tried to contact Disney to do a similar thing that Warner Brothers did, which is to rearrange the contract when they were aware that it might be going to streaming, but then heard nothing back from them. So she believes that she has lost up to 50 million in revenue from this. I don't know how they come to that number, because when I looked at how much it had made, but maybe that was just the opening weekend, it was something like 167 million. And then you think of the cost of the movie, I'm thinking, how do you get 50 million from that? But she's made 20 million so far from it, I believe, from a tweet that was released. So there's been an update yesterday where Disney has basically said that they're upset with her, that she hasn't really got a leg to stand on. and then her agency have gone back to her and sort of had a go because they raised her salary in it, and they say they're trying to diminish her character. And a part of me thinks that this could possibly just be the fact that obviously her agency stand to make money as well. So it's not even just that, you know, whether she cares or not. It's, here's the contract. Our agency want to make money also. So it's not just Scarlett's money. It's a percentage that probably would have been taken by her agency.
Yeah, I mean, in the first instance, this strikes me as the classic tale of two American companies with effectively blank checks in the form of Disney and Miss Johansson's agency. Basically just kind of, you know, spending money. But I do find this interesting for a number of reasons, because I would have thought that Miss Johansson's agents would be really quite good at negotiating contracts. And I would have thought, obviously, there was a time when things were just released to the cinema. And then I would have thought that probably about 10 years ago, or certainly 5 years ago, when streaming became more common, the lawyers who negotiated these things would at that stage have been thinking about, okay, how are we going to manage revenue calculations in this new age of streaming? So this whole sort of concept, or the whole argument that, well, hold on, Disney, you know, you release this onto a streaming site and it was supposed to just be released to the cinema, and so she's lost money. I'm amazed that in 2021 this is becoming an issue, and that it hasn't been, you know, a standard part of contracts of this nature for at least 5 years to make absolutely clear what the arrangement is going to be.
I mean, when Disney Plus first came out, what, a year ago now, or over a year ago now? You'd have thought that at that point, especially given the fact that a lot of her most recent work would have been within Disney, and also the fact that Disney owned pretty much everything, then, like, including Fox now, that definitely would have come into. So there's one thing you're saying, yeah, with the rise of streaming, you believe that they would have been a bit more savvy in general. But then we're also talking about the rise of a streaming site that is literally owned by the company that she's making lots of money from and has made, I think, 9 films, they said. I haven't double checked that, but someone said it was something around 9 films that she might have appeared in some way, shape or form, as a side character maybe. And then obviously a role that's slightly larger with things like the Avengers. And you'd think that when that came about, that they would definitely at that point gone, okay, all of her movies, all of these Marvel movies, they're coming onto Disney. They're also doing all these side series and things along those lines. So literally as Disney was starting up, you think they would have got a bit more involved in that process and what it means to their client.
Yeah, absolutely. As I say, I just find it absolutely baffling that, you know, this is suddenly kind of becoming an issue. But if we take it at face value and we assume that it is an issue now for the first time and nobody's really thought about it, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, this is one of those reasons why you have written contracts. And no doubt there is a very, very long and very detailed performance contract agreed between Miss Johansson and the Disney Corporation, because it will provide for the manner in which she's paid. And I'm sure these things are quite complicated, but fundamentally, it will be a matter of having recourse to the contractual agreement. And if it's the case that the agreement refers to, you know, a payment to her based on gross profit or something from the cinema release, then that's what it is at the end of the day. And if they haven't thought to include a provision for other streams of revenue, like a streaming service, that strikes me as, that's life. You know, this is effectively a business contract.
This is where it's not 100% clear in the articles that I've read. Obviously, I haven't got a visual on the contract, so I can't say for certain. But it does seem that, from the wording that seems to be being used, is that it's not you get a percentage from... Well, it is you get a percentage from the theatre release, but that she is also promised a theatre release. As in... But then again, she is getting a theatre release.
Which she's had, yeah. So this is the
thing. Just alongside the streaming.
So if the argument, I mean, I as I understand it, because I also saw this, I think, yesterday or the day before, the argument effectively is, well, look, you know, we thought that this was just going to be released in cinemas, and therefore, effectively, for a period of time, 100% of the income would be from cinema ticket sales. And instead, because it's simultaneously released on streaming, you know, maybe 60% is cinema, 40% is streaming. And so there's effectively a sort of 40% loss of income. But, I mean, if the agreement was this is going to be released in theatres and you will get an income based on a percentage of that profit, well, that's what's been done. But that's why I find it so strange that there hasn't been any consideration of this, you know, years and years ago. But it seems to me that this is a degree of posturing. And I wonder if this is the sort of thing where the long-term goal, as far as the Scarlett Johansson's of this world, or perhaps more accurately, her agency, the long-term goal is to get these contracts renegotiated in such a way that going forward, it is standard practice for artists to recover profits based on streaming as well as a theatrical release. And perhaps this is seen as the opening skirmish in what might be a much larger matter.
Or possibly... or possibly to force cinema back into... Yeah. Because I don't know whether they make more from cinema release. I can't imagine that if renegotiated, they could make more, because technically, from a streaming standpoint, there's no middleman. So yes. you're not paying a cinema to put this movie on, and therefore part of your ticket price goes towards the cinema, which you're paying directly to the company that gives you the film. So you pay £20, it goes directly into the pockets of Disney, instead of paying £11 or whatever it is these days. I think it's about £12.50. And then you see the film, but I would say, how much do you reckon goes from that towards the cinema? It's got to be at least half, hasn't it?
I would have thought, somewhere between 40 and 60%, I would guess. But
or maybe they just make all their money from their, £7 Coca-Cola.
Well, yeah, quite possibly. But a lot of this stuff in the realms of, entertainment and stuff that the public is interested in, a lot of it is more just about how can you swing public opinion on your side to then get the result you want, rather than necessarily looking so much at the kind of black letter law in terms of, well, what does the contract actually provide? So the long-term plan here might be to create a situation in which the public opinion is very sympathetic to the artists and not organizations like Disney. And it just becomes therefore untenable for Disney to do this sort of thing and deprive the artist of millions of dollars, even though in this particular case, it may be very clear that Disney contractually have not done anything wrong, depending on what the terms of the contract are. Because it seems to me that there are only really two possibilities in terms of the contract itself. Either the contract provides something to be done in the case of streaming, in which case, just do that, or it doesn't provide for any sort of revenue from streaming, in which case that's what was agreed and she'll get her revenue, whatever it is, from the theatrical release. So it seems I don't really see how there's room for argument here, which is why I think it's much more likely to be a slightly longer term game of shifting public opinion one way or the other.
But do you think it could have a negative outcome on sort of streaming if, for some reason, I don't know how it would happen, that people like Scarlett wins the case?
Yeah, I mean, I think it certainly could, because presumably, Disney Plus has kind of earnings projections for the years to come. A large part of that will be based on the number of subscribers that will be paying, precisely because they want to see, Black Widow 2 or whatever in the next few years. And if the only place to get it is Disney Plus, then, that's what they'll do. Or if it's more convenient for them, you could go to the cinema, you could watch it at home, they'll watch it at home. So obviously, if you then are in a situation where public opinion changes, people say, look, we're not going to support Disney Plus because we're not going to support these kind of, in heavily inverted commas, exploitative business practices, because I'm mindful that we're dealing with somebody who's still being paid $20 million for a film. So, she's not on the breadline. But if that becomes the tenor of public opinion and you find that people are, cancelling their Disney Plus subscriptions, or simply saying, well, what we're going to do then, I would have been one of those people that would have, just watched it at home, but I'm taking a stand and I'm going to the cinema to pay the artist that little bit more. Then that could have a massive impact on streaming services, because then they become much less profitable. The projections will have to be reconsidered.
Yeah, I was thinking more along the lines of like costs going up for like rental of these movies, or because I think a lot of people enjoy this sort of watch from home style. I know some movies I could see, I would watch them from home if possible. I mean, I do miss the cinema, but it is nice to know that it's just 20 quid. If you got three people come over to your house and you pay £20, that's far less than a ticket. And if you're that bothered about film, I mean, I paid £15 to watch Mortal Kombat, which was all kinds of okay. And we watched that at home, and that was only, about £4 more than it would have been? No, probably about £3 more than it would have been at the cinema. And I got to watch it at home, and I was able to make my own food from the kitchen instead of spending a lot.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, I think you may be right. I mean, maybe the solution is going to be, as far as Disney are concerned and other streaming sites, you know, we're going to have to increase the subscription fee because we're not going to have the numbers of subscribers. So the subscribers we do have are going to have to pay more. That would be one way of doing it. But again, I think it will largely depend on the way in which public opinion shifts, because if there's a very clear, you know, public support for the idea that what Disney have done is wrong and bad, I think if Disney then respond in 6 months' time by saying, by the way, we're going to put up the cost of our streaming service by 20%, yeah, that's going to look even worse for them. So it's an interesting one. I would be very... I'm putting down a marker now and saying I would be very surprised if this actually goes to court. And if it does, there will be a segment on the podcast where I sing in a high-pitched Joe Pasquale voice, "She'll be coming around the mountain when she comes." That is how confident I am that this is not going to get in front of the judge.
About Scarlett Johansson.
Scarlett Johansson.
Yes, I mean, I don't think public opinion will weigh too much in on this. Not when, you know, when torrent sites were at their height, no one cared too much about nicking the movies and not giving the money to the artist at the time. So I doubt they're going to want to.
I mean, torrent sites were slightly different, weren't they? Because public opinion was very much, this stuff is too expensive and we should have it for free.
Yeah, so I don't think anyone would want to affect, you know, if they can watch these things and get it cheaper on a streaming site, I don't think they're going to lose sleep that comes at the price of Scarlett Johansson only making 20 million when when previously they would have been willing just to take it for free and her make nothing from their view of the film.
True. We'll have to wait and see. I suspect there's going to be an awful lot of argument, you know, sort of open letters back and forth between Disney and the agency, talking about, you know, how unfair it is that this is an exploitative practice, and how, you know, they've acted in a way that's unjustifiable, with Disney responding with things like, well, we have a streaming service and that's good for our customers. And exactly as you've said, you know, it will keep the cost low for the home user, all with a view not to particularly persuading each other. But I do think that efforts will be made to influence public opinion.
Just so it looks good on the outside, yeah. I mean, maybe Scarlett Johansson. maybe she, you know, Black Widow is now dead as of Endgame. This movie
spoilers for Endgame.
This movie is set... in the past, just after Civil War. I watched it a few weeks ago on the streaming service. and so maybe she's just trying to get a little bit more money out of it before she leaves. She's like, oh, this should have been my golden goose before, well, not retiring, but I'm guessing when you're in the MCU, you've got this sort of at least guaranteed source of income, decent income. So now you're dead. She's like, okay, right, the cash cow is gone. I'll move on to other things, but you know, I want to take all the money I can from that film. I mean, she is a title character as well, so
yeah, absolutely. I mean, you heard it here first, dear listener. Black Widow is Scarlett Johansson's final film before retiring. Never let it be said that we do not have scoops here on the podcast. Next week, we'll be interviewing Scarlett about her career and her ambitions going forward, as she goes off to join the Russian military.
There you go. The real Black Widow.
Exactly. Before we move on from this case, you mentioned in passing the Cruella de Vil. I can't remember her name now, the actress that played
Emma Stone.
Emma Stone, thank you. And that put me in mind of, obviously, 101 Dalmatians. Get ready, therefore, for a tangential tangent.
I hope you remember that theme for any future tangential tangents.
You'll be able to just cut it out and add it in. For people.
All right, we'll keep that. I'll keep all the little sound clips.
Exactly. Do you know, obviously, 101 Dalmatians was a book. Do you know that there was a sequel to 101 Dalmatians?
There's 102 Dalmatians. It sounds Disney.
No. There was a 1967 sequel, written book sequel by Dodie Smith called The Starlight Barking. Have you heard of this?
No.
Now, you may be wondering, why is it that they did 101 Dalmatians as a film, then they made up 102 Dalmatians when there was already in existence a sequel to 101 Dalmatians? Surely you would just make the film A Starlight Barking.
It already exists. Or base 102 Dalmatians on the story of A Starlight Barking.
Exactly. The answer, dear listener, is that The Starlight Barking is one of the most batshit insane books that has ever been written in the history of literature. Let me give you a very, very short précis of the plot of The Starlight Barking. This will include spoilers for the 1967 children's book. So the story starts, the dogs who live with the, it's the Dearley family, isn't it? That's the name of the family in 101 Dalmatians. The dogs wake up and every other living thing is asleep and cannot be woken up. So only dogs are awake. Everything else is functionally dead. But the dogs discover that they can't get hungry, they don't get thirsty, they don't need anything. And they are psychically able to operate machinery and they can communicate to each other psychically via sort of thought waves. No matter the distance between the two dogs that are trying to communicate, I can see your eyebrows furrowing. this is literally the opening setup for this book. It gets weirder. So what the dogs then discover is that they have the ability to fly. They can hover around and they can zoom from place to place at tremendous speed. I think they call it swooshing. So Pongo and the other dog gather together 50 Dalmatians, which includes their own sons, Patch, Lucky, and Roly Poly. Because they have this ability to hover and fly around, they go to London and they decide to go to 10 Downing Street. They then meet with the dogs that are owned by the human members of the cabinet in sort of normal times. So the human cabinet members own dogs. The humans are obviously all kind of suffering from this weird sleeping sickness. So the dogs replace their cabinet member owners. So Pongo and Mrs. become the kind of de facto.
I mean, I already have an issue with this, like, because that does not mean that they are qualified to replace these people. That's like Boris Johnson being like, I'm going to sleep. Here's my son, Bilbo Johnson. And he's going to act as prime minister right now, even though he's actually been working at Pizza Express for the last 5 years and has never done any form of university.
Yes, it's a canine dictatorship that suddenly sort of takes place based in 10 Downing Street. As a slight aside, Boris Johnson refuses to acknowledge how many children he has. So it's quite possible that there is a Bilbo Johnson in exactly the way you've described. So what then happens is there's this whole sort of thing where they think that Cruella de Vil is something to do with the fact that all the humans have fallen asleep mysteriously. So some of the dogs decide to go to Cruella de Vil's house explicitly to murder her. When they get there, Cruella de Vil and her husband are asleep, as everyone else is. And for some reason, Cruella has become obsessed with metallic plastic instead of fur coats. So on that basis, they decide to spare Cruella de Vil's life and not viciously murder her. They return to Downing Street. A message appears on a television with a strange voice that orders them to say, by midnight, all the dogs on Earth have to be outside and can see the stars. So that's a message that comes through on the television.
Okay.
Right? So the dog say, well, this seems fine. So using the psychic methods of communication they have, they transmit all of this information through the thought waves, and it's called the twilight barking. Right. So we then cut to Trafalgar Square, where there's thousands of dogs waiting at sort of close to midnight. At midnight, all of the dogs experience a strange sense of euphoria, followed by a sense of dread and terror, as I can see your eyebrows are even more furrowed.
I'm waiting to see what's going on. Okay, I'm intrigued.
Let me pause there, right? What do you think happens at this stage? They've been told by a mysterious voice to go outside.
This is a children's book, right?
This is a children's book, absolutely. What happens next?
Because so far, this is the sequel I would have made. Dogs aren't from Earth. Dogs are aliens. So their original dog counterparts come back and take them to the planet Doggo.
I'll tell you what, you're pretty close.
Okay.
So what happens is Sirius, the Lord of the Dog Star, appears on Nelson's column, and he tells all of the dogs that he is very lonely. And he tells them, look, it's quite likely, and bear in mind this was written in the 1960s. So Sirius tells all of the dogs, look, it's quite likely that Earth is going to be blown up in the future by nuclear war, and the humans are going to destroy the Earth. And of course, when that happens, you'll all be dead too. So because I'm lonely, why don't you come with me? And if you do all decide to come with me, everyone will wake up. None of the humans will remember that dogs ever existed as a concept, and they'll be absolutely fine. They won't miss you. They'll be happy. But all of you dogs will be free, and you will know true joy traveling amongst the stars with me. So Pongo is told that he has to make the final decision. He consults, obviously, with the cabinet and everyone else. And the decision is made. Basically, three stray dogs speak to Pongo, and they say to him, Pongo, we are effectively lost dogs. We've been abandoned by our humans. And if you make us all leave Earth, we will never have the chance of finding the special humans that will love us.
What?
Yeah. So Pongo says, no, that is fair. So
that's not fair, Pongo. If I was on that cabinet, I'd be like, slap Pongo around the face. What are you on about? They've got no humans. They don't want them anyway.
Well, Pongo,
you're like, nuclear war, Pongo.
So he tells Sirius the dogs are going to stay on Earth. Sirius says, well, I commend your loyalty to humankind. I am now doomed to travel space alone, and I will be doomed to an eternity of loneliness. The dogs say, well, that's fine, because when the dog star is in the sky at night, we will be looking out for you, Sirius. And Sirius says, very well, you can all swoosh back to your own homes, and by daybreak, things will return to normal. That's effectively the story, with the slight postscript that the stray dogs get taken to Battersea Dogs Home, so they are looked after by the kind people at Battersea Dogs Home.
And put down, probably.
Well, quite possibly. But ominously, Pongo has a final talk to Sirius just before the dawn. And he says to him, one day, dogs may be ready to leave the Earth with you. But for now, the dogs are going to stay on Earth to be continued. So that's the story of The Starlight Barking, one of the weirdest books I've ever read.
Oh, my God. Have you actually read it?
I have, because when I was a kid, I got 101 Dalmatians and The Starlight Barking as a sort of hardback set. And I remember reading 101 Dalmatians and thinking, this is cool. And then reading A Starlight Barking, I was only about 9, and just thinking it was just mad, just absolutely mental. It's a really, really weird book.
Wow. That's incredible. I mean, he was wrong at the end. I have so many questions. You'd have gone, yeah. I don't understand why he couldn't have taken some dogs, though. He's like, I'm so lonely. Like, there wasn't someone out of all the dogs in the world that were like, yeah, I'm up for it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack, isn't there? if we ever start the Holding Court Book Club, then I would...
We will start with A Starlight Barking.
Exactly. That'll be book number one. Everyone can read it and they can write in with their questions and comments. And it's going to be great.
Okay. I will move on to... that was pretty cool. I enjoyed that. I felt like I was being told a story and just like, yes, like round the fireplace. I'll briefly go over this one then. We won't spend too much time. But this is a kind of crazy. It's more about... So it was a murder in Poland by a novelist called Christian Bala. So imagine you were out fishing one day and then this bloated corpse appears and you're like, call the police. And this person that's been murdered has been killed in quite a horrible way and quite a distinct way. Okay. Ooh. They were killed, I believe their name, second name of Janusz Suski. So he's a 30-year-old advertising company director who was found semi-naked in this water, killed by having his hands tied behind his back and in a sort of, and then a noose around their neck. So if they took on the rope, it sort of, you know, tightened around their wrists and around their neck. I believe that was kind of idea, a bit like a really horrible sort of cat's cradle. I don't know if it was around their feet as well. And they were starved and they were killed. That's the horrible semi-starvation and torture and eventually murdered. So they couldn't find out who it was. And about 3 years later, a detective that was working on the case came across this guy called Bala. His name is Christian Bala, KrystianBala. And so he was already slightly suspicious because the phone of this guy, this advertising agent, was sold on a website. They traced the number and then they found this guy that had bought this phone. And when they went to find the user who sold the phone, the user was this Christian Bala. But that's not the thing that really condemned him. What really condemned him was that Christian Bala had written a book called Amok in 2003 when it came out, around about the time that he was taken to court. And it turns out in this book, Amok, there is a character called Chris, which is close to Christian, but the English spelling, C-H-R-I-S. And in this book, Chris, it's about a killer. And they murder someone in pretty much the exact same way that the body was found in the water. So basically, there were facts about it that were just, you'd have had to have been there to know. So like, pretty much the whole thing about the rope around the neck, everything leading up to it was written in this book from a fake perspective. So basically, they used a sort of fiction book to pretty much admit to the crime, but of Darius Januszewski, that's the one who was murdered. And I just thought that was a crazy thing that he basically admitted to it and that helped them to get him to arrest him. I mean, that, and on top of that, there was the phone and things of that nature. Also, I don't know whether this is true or not. This part came off Wikipedia, but they found some things on his PC or a sort of rough copy of his second book. And the police report evidence found on his computer of plans for killing a new victim to tie in with his second novel.
That's weird. I mean, it's particularly strange. I know we've discussed before things like O.J. Simpson and, you know, the Japanese cannibal case and that kind of thing, of people who, you know, are at the very least accused of committing crimes. And in the case of the Japanese cannibal, actively accept that they did them. And then they make a load of profit out of writing books and things about, you know, what they have done or what they might have done. And then this seems as though it's sort of putting the cart before the horse, and he's written the book about the murder, which has then been used to condemn him, which is a very odd a sort of ballsy thing to do, I suppose. I mean, it doesn't strike me from a legal perspective, doesn't strike me as the strongest case. I suppose it would depend on how many coincidences and similarities there were. I mean, as you say, you know, there were things.
I think he's tried to appeal it twice, and he has been rejected. He's serving 25 years.
Right.
So I'm not 100% sure. There must have been some other stuff that was found once they believed him to be the killer.
Yeah.
I think that was just sort of, because once he was linked to selling the victim's phone online, then they found that he had basically written a whole thing. Like, he pretended not to know the guy, but it turns out that the guy who died was sleeping with his wife.
Okay. Well, that puts a slightly different perspective.
Yeah,
on
so there's definitely some motive there.
Yeah.
There's a couple of things of him pretending not to know about him, but having information on his PC with where they believe that they knew each other. Also, there was something like a Crime Watch based program or things looking for information that was put out on the internet, and it was logged that he had logged on to these things to look at them from different areas when he was on a trip around Europe. So they could see that he had logged on and was basically keeping an eye or logging in and looking at this case and the people coming forward on this Crime Watch Help Us Find the Killer page. So they could see that he was logging on at individual times from different countries as he was on this tour. So I'm guessing every time he sort of traveled every week, he was logging on to this site to have a look. So there's definitely a hell of a lot of suspicious behavior there. There seems to be motive. He had the victim's phone. He was checking up on that. And he wrote a book that basically pinpoints everything that happened in the murder on the website. So, yeah, because I was thinking, I thought one thing to discuss was, what are the chances, if you know someone and you write something like that, that you could get someone sent down for it?
Well, this is the thing, because, I mean, as with most, not necessarily all, but as with most offences, it would have to be proven by the prosecution beyond a reasonable doubt. And there is a degree to which one can draw inferences from, you know, circumstantial evidence or things that require an explanation. And one of the concepts that we have in practice, it's not really a rule of law, but it's a sort of, I mean, it's sometimes referred to by judges, but it's a thing called an evidential burden. So we've talked a lot before about the burden of proof. You know, to what standard does somebody have to prove something in order for it to be a fact in court? And in the criminal sphere, generally, the burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt. But there is also this thing called the evidential burden, which, as I say, is more of a sort of rule of thumb or practice. But what it is it's a concept where, yeah, a case is raised against someone. And so that someone then has a burden to produce some evidence to try and explain something that seems otherwise strange. So it may not be a formal legal burden, but it's effectively the sort of burden of trying to explain away something which is far too coincidental to simply be dismissed as happenstance. And this strikes me as the kind of case where, when you were first telling me about it, I thought, I'm not sure that there would be enough going on here to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. You're looking more at this kind of evidential burden of, well, how do you explain, all of these strange little discrepancies? But the more I heard of it, the more it seemed as though, as you say, there was a clear motive and there were too many points of coincidence. And although in a strictly legal sense, defendant didn't have to prove anything, I suspect if he was simply saying, well, this is all just a bizarre series of coincidences, it wouldn't be that hard for a member of a jury to be satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that the prosecution have made out their case. So it always comes back to burden and standard of proof, whilst adding in the unknown quantity of, you know, the way in which a jury is going to assess the evidence. So you would need enough points of convergence to build a strong enough case. But if it's, you know, if there's too much unanswered, then that can be sufficient.
Well, I do find, so at the start of the article that I read, I think it's The Guardian, it mentions that they're speaking to him, the killer. They've obviously got an interview, and he's stating that it's ridiculous, you know, and he's still fighting it. I think that we can waiting on either a second or third appeal. And he's saying, I could point at every line in this book where the murder is described, and I can, you know, sort of refute it. But he seems to be very, very solely sticking to the evidence from the book, like what you say when we first read, like, you know, that us, there could just be a coincidence, and not really putting forth an argument for everything else that went on around it.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, all right, that's great. You know, but why have you got the guy who died like that's phone? And why did you sell it? And also, you know, why were you kept checking on that crime site before you even wrote this book? I mean, I guess you could argue, if it wasn't for the phone, that if you're checking on the crime site, that he might have been interested by the crime, and therefore he kept keeping an eye on it, and therefore from what had happened, it influenced the murder in the book. Because then you're just a guy, like, if we follow a story, like that story of the crematorium that was selling body parts that we spoke about, and then I decided to write a book, and in that book it had a similar sort of thing that, because I was intrigued by this story, so then wrote a sort of fictionalized story that involved something very similar. You could kind of argue that, but then also the fact that he has a personal tie to him and his wife. I'm guessing there are more stuff in there about exactly how things were done instead of just a general overview and facts of how the body was found, which make it a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it does sound as though there are just too many things that, you know, are not explained. This does remind me, actually, of a case which I looked at very, very briefly years ago when I was doing my law degree. So I don't remember many of the details, and the details I do remember, I may get wrong. But but the fundamental point was, I think it was two men. I think they may have been sort of brothers or father and son or something like that. And they were accused of, I can't remember if they had robbed McDonald's, as in sort of gone into the shops and stolen money, or if they had done a slightly more sophisticated fraud of McDonald's. But in any event, they had taken money from McDonald's, quite a lot of money from memory. And what then happened is they skipped the country and they went, I think, to Panama. And part of the evidence that was used against them was photographs from this time in Panama, which were just loads and loads of pictures of these two men posing outside of McDonald's branches. And part of the prosecution case was, why on earth, if you were nothing to do with knocking off McDonald's, as we suspect that you were, why were you standing outside? You know, why were you taking all of these pictures outside McDonald's? And I think their argument was simply, well, you know, it was just weird to find McDonald's in South America, and we just kind of thought it was funny. But the prosecution case was, you took these pictures deliberately because the whole reason you were in Panama was because you'd been knocking off McDonald's shops. So this sort of thing does happen, you know, and you do get those things where it's like, well, you know,
yeah, it's a strange thing.
You have a burden of proof. You need to try and explain this.
It's strange to argue against knocking off McDonald's by supplying the court with pictures and pictures of you outside McDonald's.
Yes, I think there'd been a bit of covert surveillance or something like that. I think they'd been sort of tracking them, so it then became part of the evidence in the case. And from memory, the sort of case went on to an appeal about the admissibility of evidence and to do with the relevance of evidence, I think, because what the defendants were saying was effectively, well, this is irrelevant and it's going to prejudice the jury against us. And the prosecution was saying, well, if it's going to prejudice the jury against you, that maybe makes it relevant because it has something to say about the case. You know, it's up to the jury effectively to decide whether they believe your explanation, that you were just happening to take pictures of McDonald's, or whether, as we say, you did it quite deliberately as a way of kind of referencing your crime.
Yeah, because the prejudice isn't like something about their character or their past or something like that to prejudice them against, not liking them as individuals. It's literally pictures of them outside of loads of McDonald's. So therefore, yes, it would prejudice them towards thinking if someone, you're going to knock off McDonald's, maybe it was the guys who were outside loads and loads of McDonald's. It's not a personal thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little bit like arguing, you know, you can't possibly put this bloodstained knife with my fingerprints on it into evidence because it might prejudice the jury into thinking that I committed the murder. You do get these kind of these little interesting things where it's a question of drawing inferences. And there is, of course, now the whole problem. I think I'm probably going to get this wrong, actually, but I think it's the Youth Justice and Criminal Evidence Act, which introduced the idea that you no longer had a right to be silent as a suspect. It used to be, of course, that you had the right to remain silent, but anything you did say would be used against you in evidence. The position now is, as reflected in the police caution, you have the right to remain silent, but if you do not mention when questioned something which you later rely on in court, then that can prejudice you. It may harm your defence if you do not mention when questioned something which you later rely on in court. And that reflects a change in the law, effectively abolishing the right to silence, so that if, for example, you fail to account for marks on your clothing when you're interviewed by the police, so say you've got, you know, blood-stained clothes and you give a no-comment interview and you just say, you know, it's up to the police to prove that this blood is to do with the crime I'm now accused of. If you then get into the witness box and you say, oh, I had the blood because I worked part-time as a butcher, and actually it was just, you know, blood from the animals that I'd been killing during my day job. So you haven't mentioned it before. The jury can be invited to draw an adverse inference that that's not true and that you've made it up. So coupled with this concept of the evidential burden, you now have this idea that really you need to put forward your case at an early stage. Because if you simply sit back and say, well, it's for the prosecution to prove it, part of the evidence can be the fact that you either haven't responded at all or that you responded so late that it's unlikely to be true.
I see. Ah, that makes sense now. Yes. What's that? The Miranda rights, isn't it? Is that what that's called?
Miranda rights are an American thing, aren't they?
That's an American right. What's the?
I think Miranda rights are, that's the right to be informed, I think, at the point of arrest of your rights.
Oh, okay.
And I have a feeling that if that information isn't given to you at the point of arrest, then it in some way invalidates your arrest, because the Americans take a very much more prescriptive view to the admissibility of evidence in court than we do here in the UK. My limited understanding is that the American system can be very much excluding evidence on the basis of procedural defects, whether or not those defects have any material effect on the quality or probative value of that evidence. It can simply be police didn't follow the procedure and therefore the evidence goes out. Whereas in this country, we take a much more nuanced view in general terms. And even in situations where the police don't follow the rules, it doesn't automatically mean that evidence is excluded that might be relevant and probative. So I think that's right. But dear viewer, forgive me, dear listener, if you are American in particular, then do let us know exactly what the Miranda rights are.
So that leads us into our final section, the I Call Bullshit section of the show.
Hooray!
I've got a good one for you this week, Mike. The I Call Bullshit section of the show is where I will read an article title or a quick overview of a story to Mike, and Mike will let me know if he thinks it's bullshit or if it's true. This is so that we can weed out the sort of fake news that gets shared around the internet in meme form or things of that nature that claim crazy crimes have taken place or court cases have taken place, and it gets shared many, many times and people believe it, but sometimes it turns out to not be true. So, Mike, I Call Bullshit this week, true or false? Man who robbed bank wearing pillowcase without eye holes arrested after fleeing very slowly then stopping to pat a dog.
I was with you the whole way, apart from and then stopping to pat a dog. Because I can completely see somebody putting on a pillowcase, not having eye holes, not being able to see, and sort of staggering out of the bank or whatever. Did you say it was a bank or a post office or something?
Bank.
Bank, sorry. Staggering out of the bank and thinking, you know, this is still fine because they don't know what I look like, even though I'm going very slowly. But stopping to pat a dog? I'm not sure anyone in their right mind would do that. So, but then, dogs are cute. Oh, this is tough. I'm going to say this is bullshit, that I'm really not sure.
This is true. This is true. This is in the Independent. So basically, it was a bank robber who wore a pillowcase with no eye holes as a disguise, was arresting after fleeing very slowly, then stopping to pet a dog, a court has been told. Matthew Davies, 47, robbed the Bank of Scotland branch in Dunfermline, Scotland, armed with a meat cleaver last September. It says last September, we're not quite sure when this case is from, 2020, so 2019. He pulled his weapon out of a pillowcase before putting it over his face in an attempt to conceal his identity. But during a hearing at the High Court in Glasgow, the robber was forced to remove his makeshift mask because he couldn't see. This was due to a failure to create eye holes. Despite his botched plan, Davies escaped with almost 2,000 before momentarily stopping to pet a dog. He is now in custody after pleading guilty to a charge of assault and robbery. So basically, during the raid, he told the cashier, "Give me the money, I am effing warning you." They started out, so I will not swear on their behalf. Davies was handed £300, but he demanded more and pointed towards a female customer, saying, "I don't want to effing hurt her." After banging on the glass repeatedly with the cleaver, he grabbed 1,980 and left. But a man going into the bank decided to tail the robber as he escaped, following him to the street where he stayed. Mr. Ronnie, I think who followed him. Davies was described as walking slowly, even stopping to pat a dog. Police found cash, a pillowcase, and a stun gun in Davies' house. The robber also pleaded guilty to possessing the stun gun. The pillowcase was described as consistent with what he put over his head.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. I think that's incredible. I would very much like to know what kind of dog it was.
Yeah, it's got to be worth something. I mean, it doesn't state how he escaped is where the issue comes in. It says very slowly. And if it was like once he robbed the bank and got out of, say, the bank, he thought, "Phew, I'm clear." Yeah. And then just started wandering down the road like a normal citizen again. Like what you've got to do is, he was always taught that once you're outside the bank, you're safe. But you need to get yourself out the bank first. And then no one can get you. Not like you need to get away from the whole scene of the crime or the surrounding area and get to somewhere safe. So it sounds like if he's going very slowly, I just get this feeling of this nonchalant walk when he leaves, takes his pillowcase off his head. And he's just like whistling as he walks down the street. Maybe he jumps on the bus. And then this guy follows him and he's just like walking down to his house. And then someone comes with a nice little dog and he pets it. I mean, it must be a really nice dog. I would say a chow chow.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Or a multi-poo, something like that.
Just like a pure floof.
Yes, yes. I mean, you'd be blooping some snoot. And I think that's the only situation in which this makes sense, because it would have to be a pretty impressive dog. But yeah, I mean, you're right. This idea that kind of that all you've got to do is get out of the bank. That's the thing. As long as you can get out of the bank, you're fine.
I just
think that's brilliant. And I can imagine him being a bit like, "Well, I've been misled about how dangerous this was."
Yeah, like someone called the police and they're like, is the robber still in the bank?" No, there was nothing we could do then. I'm sorry.
Absolutely, yeah. It'd be like, "Well, he's outside of our jurisdiction now. We're expressly the bank police. So as soon as he crosses the threshold, you have to phone the British Transport Police because he's on the pavement." So yeah, I did good on him, quite frankly.
I mean,
not a lot of money either. Do you say it was like
$1,980, they rounded up.
Yeah, I'm pretty disappointed that there's not a bit more.
I know, to go to prison for that. I mean, yeah, you would expect more, but also, let's face it, the guy went in with no eye holes in his pillowcase.
No, I mean, that's true. What he should have done, of course, is been, you know, that there's that French duck thing, isn't there? That French bird that you're supposed to eat, and you have to put a sheet over your head in order to do it because it's so messy.
It's because it's so messy. I thought you were on about the one where they cook the bird whole and you have to eat it beak and all, and you put a sheet over your head so that God doesn't frown upon you.
Oh, that sounds much more exciting.
I forget what it's called. Basically, it's like this little bird. It was on the show Hannibal where he spoke about it. And basically, they take this little bird and they drown it in cognac. It's not a nice thing, which is why you have to do it. They drown it in cognac, right? That's how they kill it. And then you cook it whole. And then it's literally like still the shape of the little bird. It looks like it's in like batter or something. And then you eat the bird whole, legs, bones, beak, everything. But like in the olden days when they had that meal, they used to have to wear like a sheet over their head or something over their head so that God wouldn't look down upon them when they ate it and cover themselves from being seen.
Okay. I think possibly what would happen, that I think was what I was referring to, but I just completely not understood what the sheet was all about, because that does ring a bell. The bird, out of interest, is called the Ortolan bunting. And it's a little kind of songbird. And then it's chucked into a container of Armagnac. Which, according to Wikipedia, both drowns and marinates the birds. So that's convenient.
Well, you know, you've just drowned the bird, and then you're like, fucking hell, now I have to spend 20 minutes marinating it. Well, this is two in one go.
According to Wikipedia, tradition dictates that this, the use of the cloth, is to shield from God's eyes the shame of such a decadent and disgraceful act.
Yeah.
So there we go.
So there you go. So basically what you're saying is when this guy was robbing the bank, he could have been eating a tiny little bird underneath that pillowcase and no one saw it.
Exactly. He could have just been kind of killing, as it were, two birds with one stone, holding up the bank whilst getting in a meal.
It's like after speaking to Tracy, the cashier, she mentioned how the robber smelt very highly of Armagnac. Not almanac, almanac. Is it almanac? An almanac's like a book of sports stats, isn't it?
Almanac from Back to the Future.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Perhaps that's why he left the bank so slowly, is that he was actually hammered.
eating his bird.
that actually puts the whole thing into a proper context, doesn't it? Because I would pet the dog in those circumstances.
Just to make up for what you've just done.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think that's the missing piece of the puzzle. That's why this now all makes sense. He was really, really drunk.
I think we've just cracked the case there. So maybe there's a... Well, I don't think you can get into any extra trouble for eating birds whole.
No, I mean, I think it would be a fairly minor offence in the grand scheme of things, even if it was an offence at all. I think the armed robbery would be more the problem.
To be fair, it does sound like a very niche thing. So maybe he did it the night before when drunk, got this little bird, and it cost him like $2,000. And he was like, shit, I need to get that money. I need to get that money from somewhere.
Yes, exactly. And then he only got like 1900 odd, and he was like, oh, God.
Oh,
and
no.
Then he was like, well, maybe if I pet this dog, the owner will give me £100.
And he had to use £2.50 of that on the bus.
Yes, the whole plan just fell apart, really.
Well, I'll leave it there for that week. Now we've gone into eating small birds beneath the eyes of God, which is always a nice place to end. Do you have anything to say before we leave, Mike?
I would like to warn all of our listeners that the Dreadlord Cthulhu is coming.
Okay, well, there you go. You heard it from Mike first. If it's not the nuclear weapons and the dogs in space, it's the Dreadlord Cthulhu. So
I cannot catch a break.
So thank you for tuning in. Please listen to our email at the end. Feel free to message in any cases you would like us to discuss that I can look up, especially I Call Bullshits. And we'll leave it there for this week. So, yes.
Goodbye, everybody.
If you know of any strange court or legal cases you would like us to discuss on the show, feel free to email us at holding.court@outlook.com.